Everybody, I'm Andrew White, and as the old saw goes, I ain't much, but I'm all I think about. Put this up here. This will keep me on time. We'll get out of here by 3. I want y'all to have a couple hours off before you have to report for dinner tonight. I am a grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon Alateen. My home group is the Southside Al-Anon Family Group in Huntsville, Alabama. We meet Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 12:15, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday at 6 p.m., Wednesday at 7:30 is a newcomers meeting, and at 8 p.m. is a general meeting, and finally, Saturday at 10 a.m. With babysitting provided. If you ever find yourself in Huntsville, Alabama, wanting to attend an Al-Anon meeting, if our group can't handle it, there's a couple of other groups that might be meeting at the same time that you're there. Hope you'll drop in. Housekeeping. Thank you, Dirk. I really appreciate the honor that you've bestowed upon me by asking me to come up here and talk. I hope you guys get as much out of it as I will get out of it. I always like to describe this as a fifth step. It's a nice, good fifth step. I can confess my sins to you, and you can relay your forgiveness to me. You know, so nice. You know, that kind of thing. Thank you to the committee. It's a really wonderful, wonderful venue. This is the first time I've ever been up to Mount Eagle, and it's really beautiful. Thank you for all your hospitality, and I look forward to the rest of the weekend, especially after I can finish this. You know, I love the 12 steps of Al-Anon, which come, of course, from the 12 steps of AA. The only time I don't like them is when they're being read down the list as I'm getting ready to speak. At that point, it feels more like a sentence. It feels like the countdown to execution. And I'm going like, Scott, slow down. Slow down. You don't need to read so fast. But I come up here and, you know, I heard someone say that that you're only nervous to shake the truth out of you. And I think that's true for me. You'll hear my story. My story is my story. My recovery, however, is... it's my recovery, but most of the ideas I have are not mine. You're going to hear a lot of stupid jokes, and I'm very rarely serious. I was raised as the mascot of my family. My family of origin was, we had 3 kids. We had the responsible one, we had the hero, we had the lost one, we had as the middle one, and then you got me, the mascot. I'm along to crack a joke, to do something to pull the attention away from the alcoholic, who in my case was my father. He was the worst alcoholic I've ever known, or at least I thought that at the time. I used to think that my father was absolutely, he was the bane of my existence. And I came into Al-Anon and I found out that he really stunk as an alcoholic. He didn't have near the anger issues that some of you people have. He would drink daily. He would drink till he got drunk, and he would fall asleep. Now that I hear it, spoken out loud, doesn't sound all that bad. You know, gosh, when I hear about, you know, some of the things y'all have had to go through, wow, that's nothing. That is absolutely nothing. And the fact is my perspective was so off, I had no idea that I should be grateful for that. My father, he died from alcoholism. He died not sober. And in all that time, that was 2000. In all that time, he never said a harsh word to me. I never remember him ever saying a harsh word, a discouraging word to me. And that's incredible. Now, my mom, on the other hand, she wasn't an alcoholic. She was an untreated Al-Anon. And I got to see that side of the story. And you know what? I'm just like her. I am just like her. I'm full of anger. I want to control. I want to manipulate. And I do have harsh words to say. I remember early on, I was trying to understand alcoholism. I was trying to understand this compulsion that you talk about to drink. I don't get it. I don't get the compulsion to drink. My sponsor told me, he says, you know that compulsion you have to criticize? And I said, what? He says, next time Nancy does something that annoys you, try not to say anything. And I suddenly understood better the compulsion to not be able to control myself. It was awesome. I like to start out with a little joke. A lot of you have heard this joke. Bear with me if you have. There's some newer people here. I'm hoping I can amuse a little bit. Once upon a time, there was a little boy, and he got his allowance, went down to the convenience store, and bought himself 6 candy bars. He proceeded to sit down on the bench outside the convenience store and eat those. Along came an Al-Anon man, and he said, "Son, that's really bad for you. You know, rot your teeth, make you fat, give you pimples." Little boy says, "My grandfather lived to 106 years old." And he says, "Yeah, did he eat 6 candy bars a day?" And the little boy says, "No, he minded his own damn business." Some of you had not heard that. I love that joke because it's me. I am that man. I am that man. Can't stop myself from telling you what you should know. Or more accurately, what I know. Or what I think I know. Also, I'm going to pull out all the stops today. Why not? I know an alcohol-related riddle. 3 old ladies one time got to talking among themselves, and it turns out they lived in a Major League Baseball town and never been to a Major League Baseball game. So they decided, "Hey, there's a doubleheader starting this afternoon, let's go." And they, "Okay, we'll go to the baseball game." So they stopped by the liquor store, got themselves a bottle of Jack, and went to the game. Well, as the game went on, they would nip from the bottle, they'd pour a little in their Coke and this kind of thing. And to their great consternation, it turns out that they ran out of Jack Daniels, and there was more baseball game left. So based upon that amount of data, I can tell you conclusively what inning they were in and how many men were on base. Ready? This is the bottom of the 5th, and the bags are loaded. It's awful. Just awful. What? No, okay, move on. We were talking this morning. Walt and me and Charles were talking this morning and talking about the definition of alcoholism, which is a really difficult thing to talk to pin down. I was talking to my children last weekend. True story. I'm not making this up. And for some reason, we got to talking about zombies, because my family's weird. And the children know a lot about zombies, and we have a zombie plan for when the apocalypse happens, and who we're going to kill first and eat, and things like that. And we got to talking about real zombies in nature. And you know, there's a lot of predators or a lot of parasites out there that actually hijack their host and can control them. And one of the ones that they were talking about was this wasp that comes down and stings a cockroach. And it injects a neurotoxin within the cockroach that basically renders the cockroach unwilling. You know, it can't control its limbs anymore. And the wasp takes over the movement of the cockroach. The wasp lays its eggs inside the cockroach and then steers the cockroach like a zombie to its own lair, and the cockroach is eaten up from the inside, and until the point where the new wasp emerges from it, which is pretty creepy. And I was thinking about it this week that I think my wife and I were stung by the wasp of alcoholism, and from that point on, for a while, we did not have control over our own lives anymore, and it seemed like an apt metaphor for us. It seemed like there for a while we just did what alcoholism told us to do. And for her, and this leads back into the definition, she has a definition for addiction that I think rings really true for me. She tells people that ask about it, that want to know, that addiction is simply continuing to do something despite negative consequences. which, okay, that fits pretty well. I can buy that. And then that leads into, what am I? I don't drink compulsively. And I was talking about AJ Mack, who's from Kentucky, one of my favorite speakers I'd heard several times, and he defined Al-Anonism as the compulsive desire to control the drinking of someone who has the compulsive desire to drink. And and I thought that was a really good definition of Al-Anonism, if there is such a thing. We were talking last night, one of you, I can't remember who I was speaking with, was talking about utilitarian addictions. And utilitarian addictions are those addictions to things that we have to have in order to lead a full life, such as food, sex, relationships, things like that. Those addictions are really kind of difficult to control because you have to eat every day. So if you're a food addict, it's more about balance. It's much more a balanced thing. I think Al-Anonism is about balance as well. I can't completely detach from everybody in my life. If I completely detach, even with love, from everyone in my life, I think that's too far of an extreme. Also, I can't be too enmeshed with everybody in my life, on the other hand, because that's also not healthy for me. And not healthy for them either. I don't give them the dignity to live. So I think Al-Anonism is a utilitarian addiction, as opposed to the non-utilitarian addictions of gambling and drugs and alcohol. Those are not necessary for a full life. Abstinence is the key there. Balance is so hard for me to achieve. I live much better at the extremes. The extremes are comfortable for me. I'm a black and white kind of guy, you know. I'm an accountant by training, and even though they say, what's the definition of a perfect accountant? It's a guy who drops acid and sees vivid gray. I've never seen vivid gray in my life. Maybe I should drop acid sometime, because all I see is black and white. You know, I love black and white. I get inspiration out of different places, too. There's a long-running debate in Al-Anon whether we should use the Big Book or not. Most groups do not, because it's not conference-approved literature. And conference-approved literature, they say, is very important, and I agree with them, especially to the newcomer who is just being introduced to the Al-Anon ideas. Let's not muddy the waters with a whole bunch of outside type theories, ideas, and things like that. Let's get the Al-Anon idea down first, and then we can explore outside with your sponsor or with the friends that you have. But I also agree with Lois Wilson, who, when asked that same question, she thought the Big Book, everybody should have read it by now. It was her opinion. And I love the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that that Al-Anons are perfectly within their program to read the Big Book, because it says within our traditions that we should understand the alcoholic. And I don't think there's a better text out there for understanding the alcoholic than the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So there, preaching over. I'll stop preaching. But I love the book is what I'm trying to say. If you've not read it and you're an Al-Anon, I encourage it, because it taught me compassion. When I go to an open AA meeting, I don't necessarily feel like I relate to the greatest extent, but I do feel a great deal of compassion. And I do love the steps, and I love to hear how different people go through the steps. Thank you very much, Casey, last night. That was really wonderful how you went through, some of your steps. You've given me a couple of ideas to go through with my sponsees. A little bit of history. I am the third child of three. I was, I think I was perfect, so they quit. Everything's great. We got Andy. You don't need anything else. I also think I know that I'm 7 years younger than my next closest sibling, and those two are like a year and a half apart. So it obviously took them a while to get it right. And I'm pleased that they did, obviously. My dad was an alcoholic. I don't think his disease had progressed to the point of a great deal of consternation within the family. until after my brother and sister had moved out. I know that, you know, it had shown up. We knew not to talk about it. We knew that we were supposed to ignore it. And if you didn't, then that would cause Mom to get angry at Robert. And she occasionally called him by his middle name, too. That was scary. Just like when she called my middle name. Whew, don't want that. And I, as I talked about in my introduction, between the two of them, I think I had one really good alcoholic. I had the anger with Mom and all this sort of thing, and I had the checked out, you know, vacancy from Dad. And I got to experience a little bit of both. I now understand that they were both doing about the best they could do, quite frankly. They were very sick individuals, and I love them very much. I didn't always feel that way. I had been told by my parents that I was a great kid, I was smart, I was talented, I could do anything I wanted to do. If I wanted to be president of the United States, I should set my mind to it and have at. I also, if I wanted to be, you know, a football player, well, maybe you ought to rethink that. I just don't have the coordination for that. But I was always encouraged by them. And I grew up kind of average. We were probably on the slight side, the lower side of middle class, but I never wanted for anything. Never went to bed hungry, and for that I'm grateful. I know that I'm not in the... I know that's not true for everyone. By the time I got to Al-Anon, I really thought my existence had been one of the worst ones I'd ever heard. Just lost all perspective. I went to college at University of Alabama, Huntsville, and I had grand plans to be the best computer science major you've ever seen in your life, and I ran into a thing called calculus, which had other plans for me. So I abandoned my plans of being a great computer scientist and made new plans to be a great accountant. My brother had majored in accounting, and he had gone through the same school, and he had gotten a minor in computer science. So I said, okay, well, if he can do that, I can do that too. I'd always looked up to my brother. My brother was kind of the dad I didn't have. I don't think he ever knew it, though. I told him a couple years ago, I said, you know, we call him Bud. I said, Bud, you realize that I've competed with you my whole life? And he said, really? I didn't notice. And, okay. That was nice. But he had done that, and he had gotten out of college and gotten a great job in industry and had really taken off, and he made all this money. And somehow along the way, I'd gotten the idea that I didn't have enough money. I didn't have enough of stuff. And if I had enough money, then you know, most of my problems would go away. After I got into my teenage years, I added on to that. In order to be happy, I had to have enough money and I had to have Dad sober. Those two things were necessary for my happiness. I didn't have either of those things. But I went to school with great ambitious plans. And I got out of school, and it was the recession of 82, and nobody's hiring accountants, and I got a job as a computer science guy. Okay. Well, I love computer science. As long as you don't make me do calculus, I'm a happy guy. And so I started off on my computer science career, and I worked at this big company for about 18 months, and I hated the big company. My brother had done the big company route and made it to vice president within, you know, a very short period of time and was doing great. I myself couldn't stand being a number. I want direct access to the president when I walk in. They don't understand who they're talking about. This is Andrew White, you know? I'm my favorite person. I have great ideas and you need to listen to them. So I left that company after about 18 months. I was tired of being treated that way. Went to a small company. They were so small that they ordered, when they finally got around to assigning employee numbers, they did it by first name. So I was employee number one, Andrew. So glad they didn't do it White. You know, W, I would have been employee number 11 or something. I like being employee number one. That little company rocked along for about 4 years, and as little companies will do, it didn't go out of business, but they ran out of resources to pay its employees, which ran me out of business after a while. I went for a while where they paid me in stock and stuff like that, and it was useless. I ran out of money, and Mom and Dad said, son, you got to get out of there. You're out of money. You got to do something. And I acknowledged that they were right, so I ate my pride, quit, and went back into accounting, as it turned out. It was 88 by this time. I go down to Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and become assistant controller of an envelope manufacturer down there. And I get to travel to California, and I'm really enjoying myself. I was kind of burned out doing computer science anyway. And I have to back up a moment, introduce you to Nancy. I was introduced to Nancy on a blind date my last semester in college. And I had had big plans for myself after I graduated college. I was going to go places. I was going to be a mover and shaker. But when I had that blind date with Nancy and we hit it off, I had other plans. My plans changed again. There was no way. I mean, I outkicked my coverage that this girl loved me, and I wasn't going to lose her. And I loved her very dearly. And so when she wanted to stay in Huntsville, I'm staying in Huntsville, and that's why I stayed there. She had gone down to school in South Alabama, and so I got this job in Hattiesburg, which is only 90 miles away, and we could spend weekends together and things like that. Again, I'm chasing her, and I'm not ashamed to admit that. She's still my wife today, and I'm really proud of that, too. I've still outkicked my coverage. That I was able to find one wife is a miracle. I look back on it, it's a miracle, because I was a miserable son of a gun for a while, and she stuck with me through it. Of course, she was pretty miserable too, but we'll get to that. She went down there. I got the job in Hattiesburg, and then she graduated from school and was able to come back to Huntsville, and so I find another job in Huntsville, and I'm doing the accounting thing, and she gets through her stuff, and things start going really well for us, and we decided to get married in 1990, and we're off doing the American dream. She's working, I'm working, we're pulling in bucks. Not enough, still not enough for me to be happy. You understand? I don't know how much that is, but I'll tell you when I find out. We're doing it. It's an existence. Then something amazing happened. That little company I'd worked for, where I was employee number one, after I left, this is really humbling. After I left, they changed lines of business and went into hardware, away from software. And they invented this product that defined a whole niche in the computer market. And they started doing really well. And they started doing so well that they went public. And going public is a big deal, especially when you've been paid in stock for so many years that they couldn't give me money. And suddenly all this stock that was worthless, it was sitting in the bottom drawer or whatever, they split it 17 times and it went public. And suddenly I had enough money. I had enough money. And I was ecstatic. I was ecstatic for about 3 days. Lasted about 3 days. Then I started finding other reasons I couldn't be happy. Well, there was Dad. Dad and Mom, they had retired, and in retirement, Mom had blossomed and really was doing great. She started painting. She started sewing so much and everything. Really, really crafty. They moved up to Northwest Tennessee, which was their home up near Martin, Tennessee. Some of you know where that is. And they went back to their ancestral farm, as it were, and they proceeded to live out their retiring years. And I think Mom was pretty happy. I think she really blossomed, and she'd worked all her life and never really cared for it. I got that in common with her. I worked all my life and never really cared for it. I'd much rather play. But she was really, really crafty. Dad said that he had to keep moving, otherwise she'd paint him. She would... she would paint anything. She would take her old rusty saw and, Robert, sand this off. I want to paint it, and stuff like that. And she'd knock down a wall. If she didn't like a wall, she'd knock it down. Ask Dad to build a new wall, repaper it, paint it, whatever. I always admired that about her. She was never a status quo type of woman. And, she didn't like something, she changed it. But it seemed like, things weren't going so well for him. Dad's alcoholism really flourished also. after they retired. He didn't have the structure in his day or whatever it was that was keeping him together beforehand. Or it maybe it just progressed to the point where, you know, it just got like that. And he was drunk a lot, and they got into a huge fight, and he left, and my brother and sister, who had always been the responsible one and the hero and this kind of thing, suddenly they had their own families, and they couldn't go up there and solve this crisis. So it was left to Andy. Damn it. I have to go be an adult, talk to these people. So when I went up there, I had my, you know, screwed up my courage. I straightened up my jacket. And I went up there and I told them how it was going to be, you know? And quite frankly, I didn't believe in God at the time, but I think I was led a little bit because I think it was a pretty inspiring speech. I was pretty impressed with myself. I mean, with the content. And I told them that, you know, if life on the farm, you know, I did the whole, you know, you may have heard this before, you love the bottle more than you love me. Anybody ever heard that? Tears, this sort of, God, so dramatic. I don't do drama all that well, unless it involves me. But I did. I sat down and I sat them down and I said, listen, you are very intelligent people. If you don't like the way your life is going, if you're tired of this farm, if you moved up here and it was a mistake that, you know, all your friends are gone, you know, you spent all your life in Huntsville, Alabama and everything, and you don't have any friends left up here, but you still got people, you know, around the country that love you and that kind of thing, and you should change. Just change. Sell the farm. Who cares? You know, I couldn't believe it. Mom would knock down a wall. She didn't like it, but she wouldn't sell the farm. So I said, you know, I gave them all this huge advice. I said, Dad, you need to go to AA. You need to go to AA. You need to get sober. This is the source of a lot of our problems. I probably said all our problems. Mom, you need to go to Al-Anon. You know, I don't know where in the world I'd heard of Al-Anon. I just don't know. Maybe God planted it right in there. I just direct. But I'd heard of Al-Anon, and I advised her to go. And they did. They sold the farm. Dad started going to AA. Mom started going to Al-Anon, and they moved to Huntsville, Alabama. God. Well, that backfired. I was a pretty happy guy when they were in Tennessee. Suddenly, they're much too close. So they moved to Huntsville. Dad's sober. It's weird. You know, sobriety's weird. He became a whole lot more direct, a whole lot more there rather than vacant. I'm not sure I liked him being there. Mom got sick, though. She got sick in 97, caught cancer, and died within a few months. And Dad's sobriety wasn't strong enough to hold it, or the disease was stronger, or whatever you may, I'm much too ignorant to be able to discuss that intelligently. But Dad didn't stay sober, was the result. And her dying did not go according to plan either. You know, see, she was 5 years younger than Dad. Dad had abused his body all his life and everything. And if he was going to die first, he should have died first. That was the way it was going to go. Me and my brother and my sister had already discussed this, and it was, so it is, so it is written, so it shall be. And he didn't die first. Mom died first. That didn't seem fair to me. She was the one that was actually enjoying retirement and enjoying life. Pop was, you know, he was an AA, but he didn't have the smile on his face that a lot of you have. But I still enjoyed that he was sober. And I didn't enjoy the fact that he went back to drinking. It got so bad that he started showing up at my house drunk. And I had three small kids. And, you know, they played in the driveway and stuff. And he would pull up in the driveway or whatever. And I said, I can't have this. I cannot have this. I had no idea about boundaries or anything like that. See, I'd taken Mom to her first three Al-Anon meetings because, you know, I needed to make sure she knew where it was. I didn't need it, you understand. I mean, I wasn't the one with the problem. Dad was the one with the problem. If he would stop drinking, everything would be fine. He stopped drinking and everything wasn't fine, but, you know, I didn't have enough money either. Well, maybe I did have enough money. Well, something else. There's always something else out there that wasn't right. And when she died, it threw me into what my psychologist ended up calling an existential crisis. My to-be wife back in 1982 or so and I got into a deep conversation one night over wine or whatever and decided there was no God. It was obviously been manufactured by a bunch of weak people who needed the crutch, didn't know what was going to happen to them after they died, so they needed to make up a God, just like the old Romans used to have to make up a God to explain how the sun got across the sky. That was me. I knew that. I knew that there was no God. And before long, I became a very active evangelist. You didn't even have to ask me, and I would be happy to tell you there was no God. God, I was a miserable son of a gun. And all that time I was preaching atheism, two things were occurring. One, God was still working in my life, I found out later. I look back and I can see all kinds of miracles that happened in my life even while I was evangelizing against him. I'll get to those in a moment. Second thing is that I had a God, I just didn't know it. I found out in here, in the rooms of Al-Anon, that which I obsess over, I worship. And I was obsessed over George. Now, I was talking to Scott last night, and I was talking to Charles last night. Charles spoke in Summa Tonga last week, or I think it was. Charles said that he was reluctant to listen to his tape of himself. He didn't know how that was going to go. I'm really glad I listened to old tapes of myself from the podium, because when I would say from the podium that I love George, it doesn't come across on CD as well as it does in person. It's not what I'm trying to say. I love George Washington on a dollar bill that I'm holding up. For anybody listening on CD right now, not that there's anything wrong with that. I just want you to know that I worshiped money. I worshiped money. I worshiped, the root of all evil is not money. The root of all evil is the love of money. And I loved money. And that was a really hollow God for me. It lasted until such time as the real God created a miracle in my life where I got enough money. And I found out that was a really hollow God. It didn't do for me what I needed it to do. That's okay. I switched over to me. I obsess about me. I'm the star of all my dreams. They're all in first person. And I make a really lousy higher power. Really bad higher power. I'm good for Nancy, you know. Just kidding. Johanna knows that I'm just kidding. When Dad died, I wanted to say that, so him driving over to the house was unacceptable. And it was acceptable, but intolerable. And so I made a boundary about the best I could do, not him being in recovery. And I told him that I didn't want to see him again. I wrote him a letter. That's as much courage as I could muster. And I told him that I didn't want to see him again unless he had a three-month chip. And he wasn't welcome to visit. He couldn't see his grandchildren and that kind of thing. And I knew that when he received this letter, he would fall to his knees, and he would sob, and he would cry out, "Oh, Andy, I can't believe I've hurt you that much. Of course I'll go to AA. Of course I'll get sober for you." And apparently he didn't read the script, because he didn't. And the next time I saw him was 3 years later, about 2 weeks before he died, only because I was begged by my sister to go see him. I can hold a grudge with anybody, and I held a grudge against him. I was really upset with him. And I found out later in recovery that whole problem, you know, quite frankly, if I'd been a healthy man back then, I might have done the same thing. I might have done the same thing. I might have said, you know, "Dad, you can't come over anymore." I might have drawn that boundary, but I would have done it for a whole different motive, and it would have probably had a whole different result. Not necessarily in him getting sober, but certainly without me getting all pissy and being not able to even see him on his terms or something like that. I did that because I was malicious and spiteful, not because he was drunk. Motive is big. Motive is big for me. So he died in 2000, and I experienced an odd sensation of emotions, simultaneous emotions. I didn't know you could feel things simultaneously, but I felt a little bit of grief because he had died, and it had culminated in what I thought it would culminate in, but I also felt relief, and I wasn't proud of that. I was relieved that he had died because he's not here to make my life miserable anymore. Now things can get better. And they didn't get better. They didn't get better. Oh, I haven't told you about my wife, have I? Let me tell you why things didn't get better. My wife was getting weird. Weird, I tell you. Bizarre. And I would talk to my friend. I remember the guy that set me up on the blind date. We're best friends still. And I'd say, Woody, I said, Nancy's getting bizarre. And she goes, they're all that way. They're all that way sometimes. I said, no, man, you don't understand. I don't understand her at all. And it reminded me very much, looking back on it, of the old Bewitched episodes. You remember in Bewitched, in the black and white episodes, especially when you could drink and smoke on TV. And Darren would have a fight with Samantha, and he would go down to the local bar, and he'd be nursing a drink, and the bartender would say, buddy, why the long face? And he would say, my wife is a witch. And the bartender would say, oh, they're always that way. You know, a lot of them are that way sometimes. It's okay. No, you don't understand. My wife is really a witch. And that's kind of the way I felt. I was Darren in this skit. And I would tell, my friends about her, and they would look at me like a dog watching TV. They had no idea what I was talking about. And it was so frustrating, really. I thought, I'd been raised in a home telling me for so long that what was happening was not happening, that I really distrusted my eyes. I distrust what I see and what I hear. I'd lost the ability to trust my instincts because they were denied so many times. And I'd gotten used to that or something, and so I lived with it, and I was puzzled. And in October of 2000, she did something which was amazing. Early October, she came up to me and said, I'm hooked on narcotics, I can't stop, and I'm going to get help. And I experienced that same mixture, or not the same mixture of emotions, but I, again, experienced a mixture of emotions at the same time. One, I was really proud of her. I could sense how much courage it took for her to come out and admit that to me. And I was a little bit scared. We had, like I said, three very small children. I think Alex was the oldest at 5 at that time. We were moving, just finished building a house. In a month, we would be moving. And I didn't know if I could do it all. And the predominant emotion was anger, because it wasn't fair. She was going to go off and get some much-needed help. I knew that was going to happen, but I was still angry about it, because it wasn't fair. This wasn't in the script. And I couldn't do anything about it. And I felt powerless that night. And I had a moment of clarity, which I'm ever grateful for. I'll never forget it. I was standing there. She was no longer in the room with me. And I was standing there, and I was puzzling, what do I do? What do I do about this? And I realized that my default way of doing things, again, the wasp has stung the cockroach, and I'm just being guided by alcoholism. Normally what alcoholism would have me do is that I would get angry, I would punch the wall, I would hit her. I wasn't a violent man, I never hit her, so far as y'all know. No, I'm joking. I really did never hit her. I could cuss, I could scream, I could do anything I wanted to. That's what alcoholism would have had me do. But that night I saw that that was not going to do any good whatsoever. Normally my job would be to bring in the in-laws, bring in my relatives, things like that, maybe congregate them around so they could see how put upon I was. I want them to know exactly how of a much martyr I am, how hard this was going to be, getting the three kids, daycare, and all this stuff, and boy, that Andy, he's a saint, isn't he? And I decided not to do that. I made a decision that night, and I took my life back, and I decided to get through this with as much dignity and grace as I could, and that I wasn't going to involve everybody else in the family. I was going to try to suit up and show up and just do my job as a parent, do my job as a husband and try to support her, and I was going to go back to Al-Anon. I was going to take the cotton out of my ears and put it in my mouth, and because I made the decision that night, I lost a lot of knowledge. I had no idea what to do. I knew I had no idea what to do, and it occurred to me that, one, I can't swing a dead cat without it an alcoholic, and two, I have no idea what I'm doing. My life was a wreck. Here I am, I have plenty of money, my dad is dead, my wife's going off to recovery. I didn't even know this was going on in my own home. I could smell alcohol over the phone when I was talking to dad. But here, drug addiction is going on in my own home, and I didn't know it. Turns out it was alcoholism as well. She just didn't think she had a problem with alcoholism, even though she drank water glasses full of gin. It was okay. She could stop the drugs. Everything would be fine. I'm glad she didn't persist with that. I'm really glad that she went and got help. And she remains sober to this day, which is unreal. The odds are not with the newly sober alcoholic. I know that it's normal to have a relapse or two. At least it seems that way. Maybe three. I think it's normal that people die from this disease. I think that's all too normal. But here she is 15 years later, and she's still 15 years of continuous sobriety, and for that I'm really grateful. And you know what I'm more grateful for? Is that I have 15 years of recovery inside of Al-Anon, because I'm not the same man that I used to be. I was a miserable son of a gun going in, and I stand here a really happy man. I am I'm ecstatic. God, God took all my money from me. And I'm having to work full time for a living. This wasn't according to script either. And I'm happier than I've ever been in my life. I think I'm of use to somebody rather than being a sour, whatever I was. I went into that first Al-Anon meeting. I have no idea what was said. I do know that y'all had gotten a lot smarter, though. You were suddenly talking sense. And I like that. I'm really glad that y'all got smarter, because I needed some smarts. I needed some teaching. I needed some learning. And I remember coming out of that meeting, though, and I felt good. It was so unusual for me to feel good. Because when I talked, I don't know what I talked about, probably wasn't very healthy. But when I talked, you didn't look at me like a dog watching TV. You knew exactly what I was talking about. And that was a good feeling, that I'm not crazy, that I haven't lost my mind completely, that what's going on in my home has been experienced by others, and that it was survivable. I did something really cool when Nancy told me about her addiction. I went on the internet. Anybody ever do that? Do some research. Boy, that was gloomy. That was really gloomy. I was really glad I went to Al-Anon and got some straight research. That this is survival, but even if it isn't, I can survive. I don't know what Nancy's path is. I don't know what her path is right now. I don't know what she's doing at home. It's Mother's Day. I imagine she's entertaining her mom, before she goes to work this afternoon. No, this is not Mother's Day. That's tomorrow. Okay, so she's at work. Never mind. I think. I assume. I don't have to call and check on her. Old Andy might have had to call and check to see if she was at work. But I don't have to call and check on her. You know, I love speakers in AA and Al-Anon. I heard one Al-Anon speaker talk about the fact that he used to count the number of beer can openings he could hear in the kitchen. And he would count. He would keep count of how many beers his wife had drank that night, as if it made any difference. As if it made any difference. Ha ha! You drank 18 beers last night. Well, I think they already know that. That's information that is useless. But I think Al-Anon's, and it's been my experience that Al-Anon's crave information. I crave information. If I had more information, I could make better decisions, and I could have some control over the situation. Talking about the utilitarian addictions? Control is a utilitarian addiction. I can't just cede all control of my life. Well, okay, I can. Okay. I can't cede all responsibility of my life to God. I have to have some responsibility for the things that I do and the things that I say. I have to be accountable. But I also can't be on the other side where I'm responsible and control everything. I have to have a balance in there somewhere. Don't ask me where it is. I'm still hunting for that balance. But when I remember Nancy was going to come home from rehab after the next week. And at the beginning of the Al-Anon meeting, I don't know if they do this in AA or not, but in a discussion Al-Anon meeting, they ask if anybody has a particular problem or a suggested topic. And I never had spoken up before. Again, I have the cotton in my mouth. But that day, I was as nervous as a cat in a room full of rocking chairs. And I said, my wife's coming home next week and I have no idea how to act. No idea how to act. I was so afraid that I would do something, I would be an asshole or something like that, and she'd go back to using. Or, you know, something would happen and it would be my fault. And that was one of the best meetings of my life. What I got out of that meeting, I don't know if they ever said it, but what the message I got was that I could be a saint. I could be Mother Teresa in male guise, and she might use again. Or I could be, I almost went political there. I could be a real a-hole, and she would stay sober. Why? Because it didn't matter what I did. I am the independent variable. She doesn't drink because of me. She doesn't drink and use drugs because of me. She uses drugs because she's an alcoholic and an addict. Wow. How freeing is that? Now suddenly I could try to be a good guy because I wanted to be a good guy, not because I wanted to manipulate her into staying sober. And that was really powerful. Suddenly I had another jigsaw piece of my life back. Because I had been so enmeshed with her, you know, I'd make the old joke that the first step should have read that, you know, I'm powerless over alcohol and my wife has become unmanageable. And no, I'm powerless over alcohol and my life has become unmanageable. And I saw that. And I can take control of some of the things I'm allowed to take control of. You know, the old serenity prayer stuff of changing the things I can. It started to sink in. I'm really glad I stayed long enough for some of this stuff to start working on me. Because it didn't work, you know, initially, but all I had was the resolve to stay there because at least that was an hour out of my day where I was relatively sane and I felt relatively good before I went and practiced the other 15 hours of my day. What a wonderful gift Al-Anon's been for me. I got a sponsor, not because I wanted to. I was going to get around to it, you understand. I really was. And I was in this meeting. It was kind of early on. And this woman said after the meeting, and maybe I used the group as my sponsor or something a little bit too much. And she came up to me after the meeting, and she said, "You need a sponsor." Well, I thought that was pretty rude of her, for one thing. But I could tell that she was right. But I really didn't want to choose a sponsor because I was going to Family Week like later that week. And when I came back from Family Week, I will have learned a great deal about alcoholism and about the dynamics of alcoholism in the family and in the relationships of the post-alcoholic home and in the maybe the the pause, the post-acute withdrawal syndrome, and I would know a lot more if she would give me a few days. And she was unimpressed with my analysis. And she said, which one of these men, we had three men in the group, which was a blessing, which one of these men are you going to ask to be your sponsor? Which, again, is very presumptuous. But I'm feeling put on the spot now, and so I point at this guy, and I'll ask him. And she says, tell me what he says. So I go up to this guy. I'd seen him in meetings and things like that, and I feel like I'm like an 11-year-old kid again. And I look up at him. He's taller than me. And I say, will you be my temporary sponsor? And he's, yes, son, I will be your temporary sponsor. I'm like, thank you, sir. And I go back to her, and I shuffle back to her, and I say, he said yes. That's very good. I think that was God working for me where I couldn't work for myself. Turns out, it was coincidental. That house we were building turned out to be three doors down from the house he lives in. His doctor had told him that he needed to walk more, so we started getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and we'll walk down to the church at the bottom of the hill and walk back up. And I needed every minute of that time with him. We would do that 5 days a week. And I needed every minute of that time with him. And I tell you, going through this program the first year or so felt like I was slogging through molasses, that I just wasn't getting much better. But looking back on it after, you know, I remember looking back on it after I got my year or recognition. I don't think we gave out chips then, but I got my year recognition. And I look back on it and I thought, man, I'm so much better now than I was a year ago. It had actually occurred pretty quickly. That's impressive. You guys got a really good program here. Going through the steps was amazing. I thought I had step one down pretty well, especially that night that I had the bottom. And I thought during the second step, you know, we worked for a while on it, though. He took me through. We did all this reading. We did all this writing. We did all this work. And I thought, man, it's taking a long time. But he said, settle down. And Al-Anon, we can afford to be a little slower than they can in AA. In AA, it's a life and death thing. They have to go through the steps at breakneck speed. Us in Al-Anon, it's also a life and death thing, but it doesn't kill us as fast as it kills them. He says, but be aware, it does kill. You know, we smoke ourselves to death, we stress ourselves to death, and even if you don't die, you have an existence as a cockroach that's been stung by a wasp. That's my words. And I don't want to live like that anymore. I had a taste of some happiness. I want to live well. I want to live happy. I want to live free. I want to live joyous. I'd never done anything for anybody in my life. Not without credit or remuneration. That's hard to say when you got a dry mouth. And Al-Anon taught me that if I wanted any chance at happiness, I needed to learn how to give. I had no idea how to give. But I just did what they told me. My sponsor said I should get involved in service. My dad had died by then. I'd understood that I was dealing with a disease now. I wasn't dealing with the fact that he was just a weak man and couldn't control his drinking. I was dealing with the wasp that had stung him, and he didn't have a chance. And I was dealing, you know, that I had dealt with him very harshly. I'd hurt him. And, you know, even though I hadn't reached the work on the eighth and ninth steps yet, that really tormented me. And I saw a perfect way to make amends to him because he was already dead. What could I do? And my sponsor was on the board of this halfway house here in Huntsville. And he said, we need more board members. And so I dedicated my service to him and served on that halfway house's board for 3 years, trying to help other alcoholics. And I feel good about that. I didn't do it for the credit. I did it in Dad's memory. And that feels right. That feels right. So I dedicated that service to him. And I'd liked it so much that I've never really quit. I really enjoy, I'm not on that board anymore, but I've been on Roundup boards. I've served with Dirk on several, and I chair meetings, and I'm now the chair of the newcomers meeting at the Southside Group, and working with newcomers is my passion. If I have a passion in life, that's my passion, is to work with newcomers. I think my primary purpose in life is to help families of other alcoholics. That's a noble reason to live. I never had a noble reason to live. I lived to get rich and die comfortably. Die with the most toys, you win, right? I don't want to die with the most toys anymore. I want to die having been of maximum service to God and my fellow man. That's what makes me feel good inside now. So, how am I doing on time up there? I'm okay? I got another 5 minutes at least? All right. A sip of water. I want to tell you a couple things that I've learned. I'd never learned how to forgive. And this was a problem that persisted well into recovery for me. I was listening to Ralph White on a tape. I don't know if any of you have heard of him. He's an AA. Can't remember where he's out of. But he was talking about, it was either Ralph or Sandy B. And he was talking about how if I'm disturbed inside, if I find myself just disturbed inside, that I probably either need to make amends to someone, that I've stepped on someone's toes, and I'm trying to rationalize it, or I need to forgive someone for stepping on my toes. Well, I like that. That's simple. You know, I can manage that. And I realize I know how to make amends to people, but I still have no idea how to forgive. And so I did something that my wife had passed on to me, that her sponsor had passed on to her. I learned that term now is my sponsor-in-law, which is pretty cool. My sponsor-in-law passed on to her through me, to me through her, yeah. And she had said that if you don't know how to do something, ask God. Well, who thought of that? That's the silliest thing I ever heard of. I mean, it really worked. And she passed that on to me a long time ago. She said that her sponsor had told her that if she couldn't go to sleep at night, that she should pray that if it's God's will, that he help her. You know? And I have a problem with not going to sleep, but staying asleep. I want to wake up at 2 a.m. and start obsessing over things, either work or whatever it is that's on my mind, or how I'm going to manipulate my kids into doing something that I want them to do. And I had put that into practice. You know, God, if it's your will, I would really appreciate some help going back to sleep. And a lot of times I went back to sleep. And the times that I didn't go back to sleep, well, laid there about 15 minutes, and I got up and did something else. Must not be God's will. I'll go do something else. Sometimes I get ready for work and then go back to bed later and that kind of thing. I'm weird. It messes up my hair, but, you know, get the bed head out. For those of you on the tape, I'm bald as you can be. So ask God. So I asked God that morning. I said, and I was in the bathroom getting ready for work, and I said, God, I was listening to this tape on the bathroom player. And God, if it's your will, I'd really appreciate you showing me how to forgive people. Because I had a couple of people that were eating my lunch, a couple of resentments that were eating my lunch. These people, you understand, had done me wrong. Wrong. I knew I couldn't make them apologize to him or even make it right. They didn't have the resources to make it right. And I was stuck with this feeling and this resentment, and I was unhappy with that. And so I asked God, please show me, if it's your will, show me how to forgive. And I knew that if I paid attention, if I were awake and paying attention, that God would show me over the intervening hours, days, months, years, decades, eras, that God would show me how to forgive. Because, you know, sometimes it takes a long time for me to get these ideas. God works with me over the long haul. Well, about 15 minutes later, I'm sudsing up my scalp in the shower, and unbidden, I did not ask for it. Well, I guess I did ask for it. The thought comes across to me about the Courage to Change reading about the pigeons. Some of you know the Courage to Change page about the pigeons. For those of you who don't, it's about a man who sits underneath a tree full of pigeons, and the pigeons do what pigeons do, and he gets really offended that they did that on him, and he shakes his fist at them and this kind of thing, and it turns out that pigeons are just doing what pigeons do. And perhaps he should find another place to sit if he didn't want the offending material laid upon him. I love that reading. And unbidden, that came across in my mind there. And it occurred to me that maybe I was somewhat responsible for this resentment. Maybe I'm a lot responsible for their behavior towards me. Maybe they were just doing what they do, and maybe I should find a new place to sit. And once I realized that, the forgiveness came quickly. I didn't have to hold that anymore, because before I was trying to exercise this control over the situation so it would never happen again. You know, I'll show them. But now it's in my control. All I have to do is avoid sitting underneath a tree full of pigeons. It's not that hard. Wake up and pay attention, Andrew. So that was a revelation for me. I've had a lot of revelations. First is I don't know much. I remember early in I need to wrap up. Two things. One thing, surrender. I was talking to, I think it was Walt last night, and maybe somebody else. My memory's shot. For an Al-Anon, I have a really horrible memory. I was talking to someone about a speaker that I heard not too long ago had said that every person that they knew in AA that had long-term recovery had had another surrender. That it was really dangerous for a sober person, this is his words, a sober person in AA to have 5 years of recovery. Because if you look at the demographic of any AA group, you see a lot of people with up to 5 years of recovery, then it gets real thin, and then you have a lot of people with long-term recovery. And that 5 to 15 years, he said, is a really dangerous place for sober alcoholics. And he said for him, and this is what I related to, that he had to have a second surrender. And I got to thinking about it in my life, and I've been in here 15 years now. And the reason I'm here is because I had a second surrender. I had the opportunity for a second surrender, and that surrender happened when my son, Alex, was 14 years old. We caught him texting his friend that they were going to spend the night that night, and they had some OC, which is Oxycontin. And it terrified me. It terrified me that he was going to go off and do this. He'd been through, you know, some Alateen and all this other. He knew what was going on in our home. He knew what had happened to Grandpa. He knew what had happened to his mom, this kind of thing. And yet he wanted to do this. So we put the kibosh on that. But what my sponsor told me rang true again. Don't react. Don't react. I can get in there. My, you know, alcoholism, the WASP would have me reacting all over the place, beating his ass, lecturing. I don't know what all I would have done. But again, the words from Mike rung true. Don't react. Not until you know what you're feeling. And all I knew was I was scared. So I didn't react. This happened on a Wednesday or something like that. It was during the summer. And I remember I just obsessed over this for 2 or 3 days. And I found myself in the Saturday morning Al-Anon meeting at Southside. And we were about 20 minutes into the meeting. They'd read through the steps. They'd read through the traditions. They did the welcome. They did the whole intro. They'd introduced a topic. And we were probably on our third person sharing. And I hadn't heard a word that anybody had said. Not a word. I was inside my head still trying to figure out the exact thing I could say to Alex that would convey to him how dangerous this was, that he was playing with fire, that, you know, blah, 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 blah. And he would not ever do that again. Because I needed him to behave the way I need him to behave in order for me to be happy. And suddenly I had another insight, and that insight, I'm sitting there 20 minutes into the meeting as oh, I feel just like I did with Nancy. I know this feeling, and I know this feeling is powerlessness, and I know what to do, and that is turn it over to God. I realized in a flash, 5 minutes? I will, I'll wrap it up. I realized in a flash that I didn't have to do anything. That I had instilled the values in a 14-year-old young man that had been instilled. There was nothing more I could do. The parenting is over. And I relaxed. And I let it go the next day, and suddenly on Sunday, Nancy and he and I were going to go down to Costco or someplace, and we were waiting for Nancy to get ready, and found ourselves in the sitting room alone, he and I. And I said, Alex, I just want you to know that what you wanted to do was very scary for me, I almost lost my wife. I did lose my dad to this disease, and losing you frightens the hell out of me. But I also know that you have been raised to the point where you've been raised, and there is not anything I can do or say that's going to change your mind about what you want to do. You have the values you're going to have. So that's all I wanted to say. And he spoke a little bit about it, and I don't really remember what he said. I don't really feel like my little speech there changed his mind at all. But the difference was my motive. I wasn't necessarily changing him, I was changing me. And I treated him with the dignity that I should have treated my father and my wife with for so long. I didn't treat them with any dignity, that they had a lick of sense about them. One of the best advice I ever got from my sponsor was that I should stay out of Nancy's program, and to the best of my ability, that's what I've been doing. Anyway, it has been a really big privilege to be here today, and I appreciate your patience and your attention, and I look forward to meeting and getting to know you over the rest of the weekend. Thank you.